welcome to a cornucopia of tales and tellers. I'm Simona, and today I'm joined by the wonderful David Heathfield. Hello, David.
Hello, wonderful Simona Stambatsi. It's great to be with you and everybody.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you very much. Yeah, and I've been thinking about this interview for a lot, you know, this morning so far, and really wondering what's going to come up, because I haven't got any ideas.
Well, we'll see. It's going to be very, very spontaneous. So let's see what comes up. So first of all, I'd like to ask you this question, just to introduce yourself. So can you tell us, who is David Heathfield in a nutshell?
Wow. Well, I'm a father, husband, son, brother, storyteller. Storyteller's pretty far up there, actually. I'm a storyteller. That's something I found out over the last sort of 20 or so years. It was only 20 years ago, about 20 years ago exactly, that I started calling myself a storyteller. And at first it was a kind of a garment that I put on, and it felt, well, do I really fit this garment? Is it really who I am? But now I know that it is. But also a teacher trainer. So that's a kind of list. Writer, but who I am, I'm a person who likes to learn stories and share across cultures, because the most important thing for me as a storyteller is about people sharing stories across cultures, learning about how people are and traditions in different parts of the world, and building understanding, bringing people together.
Well, that's a wonderful objective to have in life also. So David, how did you start being a storyteller? Like, did you go on a course? Did you teach yourself?
Yes to all of those things. There's lots of different answers to that question. Partly it comes from loving stories as a child, you know, Grimm's tales, reading them in the bed and trembling with the excitement and how outrageous these stories were. It's partly my dad telling stories, making up songs for me and my younger sister when I was very young. But I think also it came out of teaching and theatre, because I've been a teacher all of my career. So I started teaching after I graduated, teaching English as a foreign language. And I was always interested in the creative side of things. But it wasn't until I was 30 that I got into drama and theatre and was a member of a local community theatre group, the Brown Paper Bag Theatre Company. And the style of theatre we did was very mixed, but a lot of it was kind of a bit like street theatre, very interactive, sometimes engaging with the audience. And it was a kind of theatre I would call storytelling theatre. And then a member of that group, Jeff Fox, is a storyteller. And he was also a senior lecturer in English, drama and education, English and education. For primary school teachers, mostly at the University of Exeter. And he ran a workshop on storytelling. So I did go to a workshop a long way back. And around that time, I was writing a lot about drama in education. So those two things kind of came together: workshop with Jeff, drama in education, storytelling theatre. And I started doing a lot of storytelling in schools. But it was storytelling with drama very much. So not just performances, but workshops. So telling stories with groups of primary school children mostly, and then running workshops following up the performance where we would create a story together, or talk about endings of stories, or acting out moments from stories, or retelling. And I realized that there was a very close relationship with my way of doing drama in education and being a storyteller, fitted very well together. It's a rather long answer. So that's kind of developed over the last 20 years.
Oh, great. And what about teacher training? So you're not just a storyteller, but you also teach storytelling to teachers all over the world, and not only teachers, also professional storytellers come to your courses.
Well,
So how
that's quite a new thing that people who are not teachers are coming to courses and workshops. But as a teacher trainer, that's been going on a long time. So my first book, Spontaneous Speaking: Drama Activities in Confidence for Confidence and Fluency, that book, at the you know when you write a resource book for teachers, at the same time you start to get invited to conferences. And so around at that time, I started teacher training. So I wasn't a formal teacher training, preparing teachers for exams. I've never done that. It's always been around the areas of interest and expertise that I have. So that kind of developed, and it was around the, you know, again, at the same time that I was starting to call myself a storyteller when that began. So there isn't a kind of first storyteller, then teacher trainer, or the other way around. It kind of they've kind of grown up together. And I really believe that I have learned what I have about storytelling by teaching about storytelling. So I think that whole adage, you learn what you teach, or the teaching and learning go completely hand in hand, is very much what I live by. And that goes with stories as well. The people who I teach storytelling to are very often the people I learn stories from.
Absolutely. And about the stories you learn, I always hear you saying that you learn stories from your students, you learn stories from people all over the world. So I was just wondering if you could tell us about your process of learning stories. So what I imagine is you in a classroom with your students, and your students tell stories to you. But can you remember the stories afterwards, or do you ask them to repeat the story to you privately? Do you make some videos? Do you make notes while they tell the story in a classroom? How does it work?
It's never the same twice, really. There isn't a particular process that I use. In the case of students that I've taught, and most of my teaching has been with young adult learners of English over the last sort of 20 so years, it's been mostly students from different parts of Asia. And with those students, most of the time, I realized quite early on that. One great way of disinhibiting students and giving students confidence to speak was inviting them to do extended speaking by sharing stories, either personal stories from their lives or folk tales. And many of the students that I've worked with from China, from Japan, from Middle Eastern countries, they come with quite a rich knowledge of short wisdom tales, kind of different genre of tales than we typically know. Thinking of fairy tales or folk tales in England or around Europe, they're often short, pithy, witty tales that they all know, they've grown up with. They don't think of themselves as storytellers, but they know these stories. So I'd say, oh, I love, and I so I will tell a story that I've learned from your culture, and we'll all learn it together. And they're thinking, well, yeah, I know this story, and it's really easy to learn it, and we all learn it together. And I show them a process, which is mostly kind of drama-based, usually at the beginning. And then I say, okay, you've told me a story, you've all worked on this story. Now, is there a short story a bit like this one that you love, that you remember being told when you were young from a teacher? And so they prepare it, and they might prepare it by at home, they might kind of find it in their own language and then trying to translate it, or they might find a video and listen to it and retell it, or they might ask their grandmother on WhatsApp to tell them the story, and they, oh yeah, that's how it goes. And then often I'll get them to tell it in pairs in the class, but then I'll ask them to write to record themselves telling it on a Padlet, for example, on a shared platform. And then I give them some feedback on pronunciation, on some vocabulary, and then they'll be invited. Each week, a different student will tell a story to the whole class. And I'm talking about really short stories, like 3, 4, 5 minute stories. And you see that development, that growth in confidence is huge. Now, because of that process, I get to hear the story more than once. And out of those hundreds of stories I've heard students tell, and many of them have told the same, like a Chinese student will say, I'm going to tell you this story. And I'm, oh, yes. Oh, great. And I've heard that story, 20 times before, but that's great. But every now and again, a gem, a story that isn't just a story that I like. It's a story that hits me over the head, knocks me backwards. And I go, oh, that's exactly the story that I'm looking for. I want to tell that story. Now, there's lots of debate in the storytelling world. Is it okay to tell stories from other people's cultures? But I'm very careful, and I always make sure that student's comfortable for me to retell their story. And I always think about whether that story is an appropriate story for me to retell. And if it's a kind of a sacred story, I might think about whether it's okay for me to tell that story and investigate further. But that's one way. But often in other contexts, I just get to hear a story once told by somebody. And in that case, I have to tell them, I have to ask them, I'd love to retell that story if it's okay with you. And I need to tell it in my own words. But my best way of learning it is, can I just tell the story back to you? And that's a clear sign for me whether that person is really willing for me to give me that story. And I have to tell you, they always say yes. They nearly always say yes. And a good example, let's say Francisco from Guatemala, Francisco Perez, when he told me a story about Coyote, Conejo and Coyote, a Mayan story, rabbit and coyote. It was so fantastic. So I just recorded on my phone me telling the story back to him. And the great thing about that was he corrected me as I told it. And in a way, he always wanted to take the phone from me. So, but that kind of retelling it back to the person who told it to me is a really instant way of remembering a short story. It only really works with short stories. But then usually I'll go away and I'll look for sources. So I'll find that's an equivalent of that story, or the same, obviously the same story, but in maybe told in a different way. In anthologies that might be found in anthologies that are freely available on web resources, or in anthologies. I have quite a few anthologies of stories on my bookshelf. So I try not to just base it on one source. I try to do a bit of investigation, and I'll find my own way of telling that story, but keeping with respect to the person who told it to me, and I try to acknowledge the person when I tell it. So that's kind of, I should have said it in fewer words, but that's kind of my usual process of retelling a story I learned from a person rather than from a text.
Yeah, that really sounds like a great process. I'm trying to do the same with my students, but of course, I'm still learning to do it. So I'll take your suggestions. I'll try to include something that you experimented already.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, probably that accounts for more than half of the stories I tell these days. But a large number of stories I tell, I still learn from texts, from text-based sources. But I just love. So if you're telling a story you learn from a person, you feel that they're with you when you retell it. You feel that they're close by.
Yeah,
and you feel that I remember the people that I've learned stories from, and they are remembered to the people who I pass the story on to. And some cases, like Tawandun Hiri Nelson Antonio, who told me the story of Mbongoro, he didn't just tell me the story and say, okay, you can tell it. He said, you have to tell this story. And everyone you tell it to, you have to get them to promise to tell it to other people. It was a condition. So I have to say that when I tell that story. You know, if you like this story, you have to tell it. And children, they look at me wide-eyed in the school hall and they nod. And I think a lot of them do, which is fantastic.
Well, it's great from an outsider perspective. I can tell you that when you tell a story and you tell us, I've learned this story from this person, it's great because it feels authentic. It feels like I some somehow know that person. I'm just thinking about the example of the flying frog and Constantino
Castelomau from Angola, yes.
And I met Constantino at the event we did when the project of Around the World in 88 Tales finished. His internet connection was not very good, but he was in the same room as I was. And he was like, hello, I know the story you told David. I'm so happy to meet you. And
yeah, exactly.
It was great. It creates connection also with people you don't know.
Something amazing happens with storytelling, something that's ineffable. I still haven't got my head around it. It's a connection that transcends explanation. But when you share a story, there's some kind of opening up, barriers fall away. And even like you said, even like that, you heard me tell a story that I learned from Salamau, and you feel a connection with Constantino Salamau. That's normal in the world, in the sphere of storytelling.
I'm sure he must have thought, this person is crazy. I don't know her. Why is she waving at me saying, oh, I know you, I know your story. But it felt like, I listen to you tell that story. I now tell that story to my students all the time. And just seeing him there and knowing that he was the first one you learned that story from was just like, I need to say hello. I need to acknowledge you.
Next time I talk to Constantino, I'll tell him that Simona is telling that story all the time. And I know how happy he's going to be to hear that.
That's great. I'm happy. And okay, so I'll take a step back for my next question. And while you were introducing yourself, you talked about the book you wrote about drama, but you also wrote another book, and it's about storytelling. And the name of the book is Storytelling with Our Students, Techniques for Telling Tales from Around the World. And I wanted to ask you a question about this because, well, I love the book. I took a lot of ideas from that book. But my question was, how did that book come to life? So did you start, did you just have the idea of, I need to write a book about it, about storytelling, and you wrote the book? Or did you have all these activities that you did in class, and then you thought, oh, this could be a book, I'll write a book? How did you get the idea?
That's a great question. I can't talk about the second book without saying a little bit more about the first book, Spontaneous Speaking, Drama Activities for Confidence and Fluency. It is about drama, but it is equally about storytelling. And at the time when I wrote the book, it was really before I knew what storytelling, as I think of it now, was. So I called it, personalized speaking, what did I call them? Improvised speaking activities. And actually, they are all about story. They've all got narrative at the heart of them. It's just, I wasn't, using that term at the time. It was as I was, so that book had evolved over many years of being a teacher and using drama ideas in the classroom or story-based ideas. It's like a career of teaching until then went into that book. And then as I was growing as a storyteller, and at the time that book was published is when I went from being a full-time teacher to being a part-time teacher and a part-time freelance drama practitioner, storyteller, teacher, trainer, writer. That's when I was really growing as a storyteller. So it was a natural next step. But because I was still teaching and I was able to experiment in the classroom and try out ideas around story, and I was I used a similar approach to the first book, which is basically I live by the principle that I won't write about anything that I haven't actually experienced and tried out in an educational setting. So I just couldn't do it because you don't know what you're writing about until you've actually experienced that. And it always changes. So if I wrote about, I might have an idea for a story and I write some down some notes for activities I would do with a group of students, let's say some 15-year-old learners of English from Italy. And I'd write down those ideas and I think, oh, that will work really well. But until I go into that class and try it out, there will be inevitably things that I will modify and I will develop and I will extend and I will subtract. And then I'll need to do it more than once before then I think, well, I think I know now what I'm talking about when I propose this idea for other teachers to try out. So it was a lot of work writing that second book. And it was in a different series. It was in a series called Teacher Development. It was the Delta Teacher Development series. So the idea was the book had to fit into this format, because initially I said I want to write this book, and I've got all these stories and all these storytelling ideas, and I just want to share it. And they said that's okay, but what we want is it to be about teacher development. So then I had to rethink how I would write the book, and I had a fantastic editor, Mike Burgess. And it was so great for my own learning, because what I had to do is think of the book as a self-development book, as a book that if teachers pick it up, each story and each story, it's always a story plus activities or story plus techniques. Each one had to take you a new step forward in your storytelling development journey. And by doing that, I learned so much about how I had been growing as a storyteller. So I was kind of thinking more analytically, which is useful for me because I tend to be very spontaneous and organic, just seeing what comes up. But I was actually noticing things about how I had learned as a storyteller. So I was kind of writing my own journey. And I was learning new things through the process. And then I wrote the introduction last. And the book's introduction is quite a significant piece. It's by far the longest piece of it's not formal because it's very accessible, I think, but it's definitely the longest piece of writing that's not a story that I've done. And that was also a requisite. That was what was required by the publisher. Oh, and that was a task. I thought, I'm not an academic, I don't know. But that piece of writing was probably the most important piece of writing I've done, because it made me realise what for me was involved in being a storyteller, particularly a storyteller in education.
Yeah, absolutely. And you explained it so well, because when I first approached storytelling, I was driven, of course, by the need of doing something creative in my lessons, and I saw you telling this story and I was like, oh, I want to do it. But then when I took the course with you and I read the introduction to your book, I also realized the importance of storytelling, not just the fact that yes, it's cool if you go and you tell a story to your students, it's fun, they have fun, they learn, but why do they do that? And these are all things that I learned from reading your book.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But it is important, isn't it, to note that, yes, you can do a story as a one-off thing. And often in a course book, you'll have a unit which is about some traditional story. But where it really works is when it becomes integrated into a course and it's done with regularity and repetition. And whether it's the same story over a period, but ideally bringing in new stories and growing and having stories coming from students eventually, this is powerful learning and unforgettable learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. You were mentioning teaching through stories and helping students develop their English language skills through stories. And this reminds me of your work with the Hands Up project. So I'm not involved in the project myself, but that's what I think you're doing, right? You're helping students learn English through stories also. Is that what it is?
Yes, that's what the Hands Up Project does. It's learning English through stories and theatre, and other things as well. I mean, there are also curriculum-based lessons going on, but different volunteers can bring their own knowledge and expertise to what they offer through the Hands Up Project. So my focus has been on as a storyteller.
What's your involvement with that? So how did you start doing mm-hmm. storytelling with the Hands Up Project, and what kind of activities do you do with them?
Well, I'm a very good friend of Nick Gilbrough, who started the Hands Up Project. I've knew Nick years before he started the Hands Up Project. And my involvement initially was as a volunteer who linked up with a teacher and went into classes in a school in Gaza once a week and did some interactive storytelling activities with the students. And that was exciting. I mean, it comes with some challenges with internet signal and connectivity. I think that's slightly improved. That was a few years ago, and that was really challenging. And it was my first experience of using Zoom. So I was cack-handed with Zoom. I was nervous because I wasn't used to communicating online. It was this it's become second nature to me now. And then my more recent involvement was as doing a series called Teach Us a Tale. And each week I met a student from Gaza. Typically it was a girl about 13. I think I had one boy in the whole time I was doing that. And she would every week, so she would work with her teacher, and these are teachers that I already know because they've done training with me. Most of them have done the CREST course, which we might talk about in a moment. And then, so they knew what I was talking about. So the teacher would work with that student who loved the idea of storytelling. And that student would practice and get ready and then meet me. And then we'd do a live stream. So that student would be telling me a story, but it would be telling the world a story. And then I would listen. And my challenge was to learn and retell the story instantly, a bit like what I was saying earlier. So I was taking notes, doing a story S, like writing words and symbols, and then immediately telling the story back, which is hugely challenging, but I quite like the challenge. And they were great stories, wonderful stories. And then the next day, the student would come to the World Storytelling Cafe, Young International Storytellers, and retell the story to a larger global audience. So that was the process. And I was doing that for several months. Recently, I did a project, and that took up so much of my time that I stood back slightly from the Hands Up Project. So a lot of volunteers, you know, you have periods where you're highly involved and when you're less involved, but my involvement continues. And most recently, I've been a judge in the annual remote theatre competition, and that's an honour. And I was honoured also last week to tell a story at the celebration on the World Day for Social Justice, which was celebrating also to announce the winners of that competition. And I told a story there. So I'm very close to the Hands Up Project, and I believe strongly in the power of storytelling for social justice, because these are children and teachers who are living in very challenging circumstances in Gaza. It's hard for them to communicate beyond that prison, that open air prison, which Gaza is, and through the internet, through Zoom, through the Hands Up Project, they're able to communicate with children and teachers globally. And it's a fantastic flagship, a pioneering project that's influencing teaching globally. I think so many ideas are being inspired by the Hands Up Project. Nick is an incredible creative thinker.
Yeah, absolutely. We mentioned in the episode with Manuela Calicalzini, she's also a volunteer there. She mentioned that the Hands Up Project won two Eltons.
Yeah, it's won this year's for innovation. absolutely, you know, yeah, and totally deserved. So it's very much now recognised in the English language teaching community around the world. And I don't think there are that many countries where Nick hasn't gone to a conference and then done a live performance where students in Gaza are performing in that conference. For example, not that long ago, he was, well, actually, I say not that long ago, but was it before? I'm losing track about time with the pandemic, but Nick went to Lima in Peru, and there were teachers, and there they were linking up with kids in Gaza. I mean, what could be more amazing than that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also what they did with the drama contest. Usually two or three people from Gaza, students from Gaza, work together with two or three students from another part of the world.
A few months ago, Gaza was being bombed. And on the day of the ceasefire, there was a live performance done of a play called Lemon and Mint. And the performance was by a couple of students in Gaza and a couple of students in Ukraine, and they performed it live. And this play was about understanding difference and coming together and cooperating. And I don't need to say any more than that. That's what the Hands Up Project does.
I won't comment on that. I leave it there. So I think we mentioned most of the things. There would be so much more to talk to you about. I just wanted to ask you a final question, and then I'll ask you to share a story with us. So, David, what do you think is the best part of doing your job? So, of being a storyteller, of being a teacher trainer, are these two separate things? So is there a wonderful thing about being a storyteller and a wonderful thing about being a teacher trainer? Or is it the same thing for you? What's the best part?
It is actually the same thing for me. And, most of my teacher training is around storytelling. But storytelling is sometimes, you know, people might want to be clear about what storytelling is. It's not that narrow. So I've done sessions about storytelling in costume. So historical storytelling, when I tell stories from history as a character from history. So I'm not just talking about telling traditional folk tales from different diverse cultures. Storytelling can be telling my personal story it can be as simple as a scar or an event when I lost something and then found it again. So getting students to tell stories of lost and found. Drama and theatre. People sometimes separate the two things, but I think storytelling in many performance storytelling is a kind of one person intimate theatre. It's different from most theatre in that it's not scripted, but then theatre doesn't have to be scripted. I've done a lot of role play and I've done a lot of improvisation, and the lines blur between street theatre, where you engage with the audience and you get the audience calling out and responding, and personal story. It all blends into one. It's not, you know, people often try to divide it into compartments. So yes, simply, I like it all, and I like learning and finding out new applications. Recently, a person that I've been teaching, I've used that term loosely, or facilitating learning on a CREST course, ran a short part of a workshop on puppet making and using puppets. And there I was very much a learner. I haven't got a lot of experience in using puppets, but I'm very interested always in learning new skills. And I think going ahead with an open mind and learning new skills and learning from other people's expertise is the fun of it and the joy of it.
And David, can you please remind me of the name of this person? I was there, of course, but I've got a blank at the moment.
Padmini Rangajaran. From the south of India, and she did the CREST course, the creative and what's it called? Creative and engaging storytelling for teachers, which is a course that I've been running for the last year or so, and well, maybe longer than a year or so now. And that's how I met you, and that's how I met lots of people. And, you know, there's a community now of, you know, well over 150 teachers who've done the course. And you mentioned teachers of English as a foreign language, and that has been the majority of people who've done that course, but not only. So there've been people who've been teaching Italian. Paolo Torresan from Italy teaches Italian in Brazil, and he's done the course and is using those ideas to teach Italian. So it's not just about teaching a particular language, that's important to stress. And I've also done a course particularly for primary school teachers in Turkey who are not English teachers. They're primary school teachers, and they're learning about using storytelling in teaching their children in Turkish. And right from the beginning, when I wrote the book, even though it's published by an English language teaching publisher, I wrote it for all teachers. I deliberately set out to write it with all teachers in mind and for it to be applied across education. So that was my, I think it's storytelling can be applied in so many ways, and it can be applied in therapy and healing, it can be applied in performance, in entertainment, it can be applied in education, and all the edges blur, and there's many, many more ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever you taught us something, it was not just to teach English, related to teaching English, but also you could apply this to whatever kind of teaching you're doing.
So I think it's just a wonderful resource for every kind of teacher out there. So everybody go and check it out. And David, we are almost at the end of the episode. So I know that you have a story to share with us. And it's the story of the hunter and the antelope. Would you like to tell us something about it?
There are versions of the one wish tale in many different cultures. I often tell an Indian variant. I've heard an Irish variant, particularly from Jean Hale during the project Around the World in 88 Tales. And also during that project, I was told a version by Ralph Mama from Benin. And it's Ralph Mama's version that I'd like to retell to you. Listen to me telling it at an event a couple of days ago at Park Life in Heavertree, Exeter, to a live family audience of children. And I'm retelling Ralph Mama's story, The Hunter and the Magic Antelope, with some slight modifications, including some features from the Indian version. Story, story.
Tell us a story.
There was once a hunter, and this hunter lived with his beautiful wife and his old mother and father. They were very poor because there were hard times. The land had gone dry. There had been no rain for a long time. Nothing was growing, and there were no animals to hunt or catch. So the hunter said to his family, "I will go today and I will bring back something." And he set off across the dry land, and he came closer and closer to the secret forest, the enchanted forest, where no hunter is allowed. And he went between the trees, and the trees were green, and he could smell fresh life. And then, hopping towards him, jumping, was a small antelope. You know, an antelope with horns.
Oh, I know what an antelope is.
Yeah, it's a bit like a deer.
Yeah.
We have deer, don't we, in our country, in England.
It has horns like...
That's right. In Africa, there are antelopes. And the hunter took his bow and arrow. Show me. He was about to shoot the antelope. And the antelope spoke, "Magic, magic, I am a magic antelope. Hunter,
Do not shoot me. If you shoot me, you will have many problems in your life. Thousands of problems.
Magic.
You must not hunt anything in the enchanted forest. If you spare my life, you will have many blessings. What do you want? Problems or blessings?
Blessings!
Good choice, Hunter. And the hunter put down his bow and arrow and said, but what blessings? I will give you one wish. Oh, the hunter thought, what should I wish for? Just one wish. Oh, Hunter said, Antelope, I need time to think. Good, good. I will wait here, and tomorrow at this hour, come back and make your wish. I will be waiting and waiting and waiting. The hunter took his bow and arrow and he left the enchanted forest. He walked across the dry land. And finally, he came to his
house.
Home, that's right. And outside his home was his father, an old man. Son, what did you bring home?
I brought home nothing, father.
I almost shot an antelope, but the antelope offered me one wish and he told his father everything. And his father said, a wish, a wish. Son, wish for plenty. We have nothing. Wish for
plenty.
Plenty. Well, the son, the hunter, thought this was a good idea. Then he went into the house and his wife greeted him, his beloved wife. And he told his wife about the antelope. And his wife said, oh, husband, so many years I have wished for a child. But you and I, we have no children. Husband, wish for a child. Wish for a
child.
He went inside, he sat down next to the fire, and there was his mother. His mother had lost her sight. She had become blind. Is that you, my son? Is that you? Yes, mother. And he told his mother about the magic antelope, and she said, oh, how I would love to see again. Wish for your mother to see again. Wish for your mother to see again. Oh. And that night, when the hunter went to sleep, he was thinking, what should I wish for? For plenty? For a child?
What's a plenty?
A lot. For much. For many things. For plenty? Good question. For a child? Or for his mother to see again. He couldn't sleep. He was tossing and turning and turning and tossing and tossing and turning all night long. And in the morning he woke up and he took his bow and arrow and he walked across the dry land and he came to the enchanted forest. And there between the trees he stepped, and in that same clearing was the magic
antelope.
Hunter, here I am. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. Are you ready to make your one wish? And at this moment, suddenly, the hunter knew. He knew what to wish for. Just whisper to the person that you came with here today. Whisper, what do you think that the hunter wished for. One wish. Go and tell your mum. Who's got an idea? What's your name?
Money, Theo.
Theo? Theo. Theo, come and stand here next to me. Here. And say it loud and clear. What did he wish for?
Money.
Money? Money? What, so he could buy everything he needed?
Yeah.
That's a great idea, Theo. Do you think it's a good idea? Let's give Theo a clap. Who agrees with Theo? Put your hand up if you think money. Oh, put your hand down. Wonderful. Thank you, Theo. It's a great idea. Who's got a different idea? You got a different idea? Come over here. What's your name? Stand here. What's your name?
Ava.
Ava. Tell everybody, Ava. Big voice. What did he wish for?
A new island.
A new island? A new island. What a wonderful idea. A new island.
Oh.
Does anyone think that he wished for plenty? Yes. Does anyone think he wished for a child? Isn't that special? Does anyone think he wished for his mother to see again?
No.
Oh, yeah. That would be special, wouldn't it, if his mother could see again? Does anyone have another idea, a different idea? What's your name?
Jessica.
Jessica. This is the last one we're going to hear. Come, Jessica, stand here. Tell everybody, Jessica.
Food.
Food for himself or for everybody?
For everybody.
Food for everybody. What a wonderful idea. Come and sit down, Jessica. Did anyone think he might be able to get more? I am ready to make my wish. I wish that my mother could look at my child drinking milk from a golden bowl. Hunter! Clever! Clever hunter! Your wish is given. The hunter left the forest. He went home, and not long after, he sat beside his wonderful mother, and she was looking bright-eyed at her beautiful grandchild, and she was feeding her grandchild milk from a golden bowl. They had plenty. They had a child. His mother could see again, but not only this family, all of the families of the community, all of the families across the land. The rains came down again. There was plenty for everyone because he protected the enchanted forest.
Thank you ever so much, David, for sharing that story with us. It was wonderful to hear you tell that story, and the kids were just amazing. And thank you so much for sharing your storytelling journey with us. And I hope everybody out there has appreciated this as much as I did, because it was great fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simona. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and look forward to hearing from you all.
Yes, absolutely. Please let us know if you're enjoying the podcast, and we'll be back soon with a new episode. Bye, everyone.
Bye.